ongoing quest to liberate land and people totally. So in a sense, you know, Canifani really represented this sort of undying and unwavering commitment, you know, through his writings, through his organizing, to this ultimate goal. And so in many ways, when we celebrate Canifani's literary achievements, when we celebrate his literary prowess, we're also paying testament to that sort of unwavering commitment to the need to fully liberate land and people from the river to the sea.
Yes. Well, David, I mean, although it's rare, I mean, Israel does have a record, doesn't it, of assassinating non-combatants, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I mean, back as far as 1948, of course, they started with those kinds of assassinations. There was a former Jordanian MP who also edited the PLO newspaper, Kamal Nasser, who was assassinated. And, of course, most recently, we've seen Shireen Abu Akleh, the journalist, killed just last year. So there is a history of this. But, of course, there is also a history of an assassination program by the Mossad through all sorts of various means, including numbers of the people who we're going to talk about today.
Mm. Well, Omar, I wonder whether you could say a word or two about Ghassan Kanafani's position on negotiations with the Israelis.
Well, there's a famous line, you know, from the interview with Richard Carlton where Kanafani is asked, you know, why don't you talk to the Israelis? Talk about what? And is this talk about not fighting? Kanafani responds, talk about not fighting for what? You know, and then on and on and on. And eventually you get the famous phrase, that's the kind of conversation between the sword and the neck. So the idea that, you know, again, that, you know, and sort of unapologetic, unwavering stance that, you know, Palestinians are locked in a total liberation struggle for the complete liberation of land and people. And the idea that sort of conceding to the colonial power through negotiation that does not in any way account for the asymmetry of power that the settler colonialism, you know, of the Israeli state and Zionism impose, is tantamount to suicide and is an abdication of the right, of the need, you know, the imperative to fight for the liberation of land and people.
I mean, David, what can you tell us about the transition of the Arab nationalist movement to the PFLP that was mentioned in Latifa's report there?
Well, the watershed is the invasion of the West Bank, of Gaza and of the Golan Heights by the Zionist regime in 1967. And the Arab nationalist movement has a shock, a massive wake-up call with that. And it transforms itself into effectively a much more ready to fight guerrilla organisation. So the PFLP emerges, it has its armed wing, and that becomes much more of a significant threat to the Israelis. And they engage for many years in many different operations against the Israelis, which really challenge some of the Zionist regime's attempts to suppress the Palestinians and to maintain occupation in the West Bank and Gaza and the other elements of the occupation. So it's a transformation of footing, really, from the Arab nationalist movement to a fully socialist fighting organisation which will directly take on the Israelis. And that's a transformation which we see leading to splits within the Palestinian movement, so that parts of the PFLP, of course, are affiliated to the Palestine Liberation Organization, and other parts are not. So you see the emergence of a much more radical spirit coming through after 1967.
Yeah. I wonder if you maybe just expand a little bit on the structure of the PFLP as well.
Well, the PFLP goes through various iterations, so and different factions, and of course there are splits over ideology, but also splits over strategy in terms of armed actions. And of course there's the Associated and the Allied faction of the Black September, which moves beyond the kind of activities of the PLO, things which are accepted to the PLO. So you have the PFLP proper, then you have the PFLP General Command, GC. There's also, of course, the SC faction of the PFLP. So there's a lot of different factions in there, and that's part of the evolving sense of the guerrilla struggle, which the various different factions are engaged in.
Sure. Well, Omar, I mean, how has the legacy of Kanafani and his comrades informed your work with the Palestinian youth movement?
So we see Kanafani, you know, as really very much an enduring and ongoing and vibrant and galvanizing figure and symbol, not just for who he was as an individual, but for everything he represented. And his example, you know, the concept of adab al-muqawami, or resistance literature, is something that we really took to heart as the Palestinian youth movement. And, you know, we, among other things, we started the Ghassan Kanafani Resistance Arts Scholarship, which is to really cultivate the creativity in Palestinian youth, Palestinian Arab youth, you know, across the world, basically, to really think about the interconnection between cultural resistance and the ongoing liberation, Palestinian liberation struggle. We see really a need to continue to kind of cultivate this collective sense of being a people locked in an ongoing struggle against settler colonialism, against imperialism, and thinking about how culture in and of itself can, you know, help to kind of actualize that goal by making sure that, you know, we never forget that Palestinians continue to remain engaged, continue to reject concessions to Zionist settler colonialism and to imperialism, and continue to create works that will galvanize and stimulate, you know, and awaken subsequent generations. And I think certainly, you know, when we think about kind of a resurgent, kind of a new sort of waves of resistance among ongoing Palestinian generations, we see that there is an unwillingness to forget, an unwilling to compromise, you know, the very things that Kenneth Fanny, you know, that and his generation were really pushing for, to ensure that we don't concede, that we don't surrender, that we never forget, that this will be a pursuit of liberation from the river to the sea.
Yeah. Well, David, I wonder whether you could say what precipitated the eventual split between the PFLP and Wadi Haddad.
So you have this process of radicalization from 1967 on, and you have the move towards a much more radical approach from people like Haddad. And he even splits from his longtime comrade, George Habash. And there's a split with the PLO, essentially. And that's one of the things which is really of significant relevance today, is the question about the role of the PLO and, of course, the Palestinian Authority in actually interfering with the liberation struggle, mm-hmm. as opposed to fostering the liberation struggle, which was supposed to have been the PLO's role. And this is an early sign of the tensions inside the Palestinian national movement, where the PLO starts to in some senses, compromise, and elements of the PFLP are unwilling to compromise. And, of course, that puts them right outside the space where the Israelis are happy to negotiate what should be happening with the PLO. And, of course, today's security cooperation there is between the Palestinian Authority and Israel is a key weeping sore within the liberation movement. But you have someone like Haddad, who is unwilling to compromise, is associated with Black September, and eventually, of course, what happens is that the Israelis assassinate him. Yeah. I mean, really, really vicious means of assassination. They sneak into his apartment, they change the toothpaste in his bathroom for a poison, so that every day he brushes his teeth, poison seeps into his system, and they don't know what's wrong with him. Eventually, Arafat sanctions him being sent to East Germany to a specialist hospital, and they can't even work out what's wrong with him. He dies in horrible pain, and this is typical of the Israelis, the kind of strategy they've used to assassinate people who are outside the scope of negotiation according to their strategies.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're just going to pause the discussion there for a moment to report about another Palestinian non-combatant, Neji Al-Alali, who was also assassinated, and also about Israel's use of double agents operating in Britain.
Political cartoonist Neji Al-Alali was born in 1937 in Al-Sajara village in Palestine, prior to the Zionist occupation. Ali was 10 when the Nakba drove his family out of their village, forcing them to flee to Lebanon, where they lived in the Ain al-Helwa refugee camp in Sidon. He developed his talent for sketching sarcastic interpretations of the political landscape at the time. Ghassan Kanafane met Ali in the camp in the 1950s and helped him get work with a few newspapers. This eventually led to Ali moving to Kuwait to work for the papers Al-Siyasa and Al-Khabas through the 1960s and 1970s. It was in Kuwait that Ali developed the character he is most famous for, Handala. The depiction of a 10-year-old barefoot and bedraggled Palestinian child with his back turned became iconic across the world. Ali asserted that the character represented the condition of Palestinian refugees waiting to return. Ali's works were not just observational pieces on the Palestinian condition, but also piercing critiques of the major political actors of the day. His attacks on Gulf leaders are believed to be behind his decision to leave Kuwait with his family and settle in London in 1985. Ali had also begun criticizing the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat through his work, particularly the influence of a female companion on the figurehead. Ali was believed to have received more than 100 death threats before his liquidation in London. On July the 22nd, 1987, Ali was shot outside the office of Al-Khabath newspaper in Knightsbridge, London. He died around a month later. In the immediate aftermath of the killing, British police arrested Ismail Sowan, who was not only an employee of the PLO, but also an Israeli agent. The Israelis paid the rent for the very apartment that Sowan was arrested in by the British police. Sowan claimed that while he was not the killer, the team that carried out the assassination had used his flat as a base for operations. The British Prime Minister at the time, Margaret Thatcher, was so outraged at this information that she expelled the Israeli handler of Sowan and closed the Mossad base in Britain. The truth of Naji al-Ali's assassination is still unknown, but British police reopened the investigation in 2017.
Omar, I wonder if you could tell us about Naji al-Ali's character, Handela.
Yes, so Handela is a 10-year-old Palestinian refugee child, and in the classic pose, you know, that you see is barefoot and his back is facing the audience and hands clasped behind his back, and many believe that this is a kind of symbolism that denotes a rejection of outside or imposed solution to the Palestinian struggle. And Handela, of course, famously remains 10 years old, right, as Ali had wished for it to be. In part, really, you know, symbolizing kind of the ongoing need for the total right of return of the Palestinian people to be implemented, and something which has yet to be realized. And so in many cases, people see the perpetual youth of this character as kind of an artistic reflection, you know, of the ongoing need to kind of end this, you know, this colonially imposed atrocity and to finally allow the Palestinian people to return home.
David, in Kuwait seems to have been a hope for pro-Palestinian thinkers at different points, doesn't it? I mean, why do you think that was?
Well, I mean, Kuwait was had a policy of allowing Palestinian refugees to come and on preferential terms compared to other immigrants from the region. And so there were very many Palestinians in Kuwait working there, I think a quarter of a million or so, perhaps more. And it was so it was a kind of refuge for Palestinian refugees, until, of course, the moment where there was the conflict over Iraq in 1990, when Iraq went into Kuwait, it seems that the apparent invitation of the Americans, and the PLO's view was to support Iraq and Saddam Hussein, and thus the Kuwaiti government expelled a quarter of a million Palestinians. And that was the moment which that was over and that game was over. And most of the Arab states, of course, were opposed to Saddam Hussein in 1990 and were effectively supporting the West in its military intervention. The Turkey Shoot, if you recall it was called, when they went in and killed thousands of people in the road to Baghdad. And so that was the formation of Kuwait. And of course, you see this process all the way through of the places that the Palestinians had to go to. They went to Jordan, they went to Lebanon, some of them went to Syria, or, of course, in Kuwait. And sometimes those places were closed down. Of course, famously, the Israelis forced the PLO out of Lebanon and sent them over to North Africa in the 1980s. So it's a process of where can these refugees go while they wait to come back to their homes, while they wait to expel the occupiers and to decolonize the occupation of Palestine. So that's the process, and that's why Kuwait was important then, and it became, you know, became a terror incognito after that because they couldn't stay.
Well, Omar, I wonder what they might say. I mean, what kind of criticisms did Ali's work level at Yasser Arafat?
So many different types of criticisms, but really the thing to understand about Arafat is, you know, he has kind of a split. On the one hand, you know, seen as a very nationalist figure, very dedicated to the revolution. But what Ali was doing with Arafat, and to a certain extent, as he did with many politicians, was really trying to kind of probe beneath the surface and kind of expose what he felt to be a sense of hypocrisy. So this idea that, you know, there's a total dedication to Palestine, and yet there's an increasing number of decisions that are made that seem to be sort of conceding to the occupier, or moving toward negotiated settlements rather than continuing, kind of the armed liberation struggle. And of course, for Ali, this was reflected in certain instances of personal corruption. But ultimately, really, the larger critique is this movement, this seeming concession, that the Palestinian liberation under Arafat was making, moving toward a negotiated settlement rather than continuing, a truly anti-colonial liberation struggle. And of course, this would include Ali's critiques, jibes, including, a cartoon sort of mocking him and mocking his so-called cultural minister, Rashida Mahran. But the political substance of it really is this movement toward concession rather than, making these decisions that really aren't in the interest of the people.
No, absolutely. I mean, David, what do you make of these double agents arrested by British police following that killing?
Well, this is a very, very interesting tale. I mean, let's start with the fact that these people were working for Mossad. That whatever else they were working for Mossad. And as you saw in the film there, Margaret Thatcher expels their handler, closes down the Mossad station. And people don't know this, do they? They don't know that actually that the Mossad was engaged in operations against Britain on British soil, that it was a hostile foreign power. And of course, as we've said in this programme before, this is one of many examples where the British security state realises that there's a problem here and it intervenes. And it was Thatcher who shuts down, of all people, the Mossad station. Now, of course, Thatcher has form in relation to Israel. And of course, there was a moment when she was Prime Minister where Menachem Begin came to the UK and she refused to shake hands with him because he regarded him as a terrorist. Now, there's the sign that even Tories can understand and get the point of this kind of spying in the UK. And Margaret Thatcher was up for that engagement. But let's go back to the other question. These were people who were PLO operatives. Were they PLO employees in the civilian sense, or were they armed operatives? And what's unclear about this is not whether the PLO and the Mossad were involved, but exactly what was the apportionment of responsibility. So it's not impossible that the PLO directed these killings, but at the same time, the people who were involved in the killings were actually Mossad double agents. I mean, we don't know exactly what the relationship was, but we already see the kind of dirty dealing and the double dealing of the PLO evident in this case, and that has only become much more significant. Mm. So that today we have the PLO engaged through the Palestinian Authority in security cooperation, including arrests and tortures of ordinary Palestinians, including killing ordinary Palestinians. Yeah. And we see that happening as the resistance rises in the West Bank. Now, we have a split, of course, in the Palestinian Authority. There are members of the PLO and Al-Aqsa Brigade, Martyrs Brigades, who are joining with the Lion's Den or with Palestinian Islamic Jihad or with the Al-Qassam Brigades and joining the resistance which is rising in the West Bank. And that's a split. And the more that split continues, the better. But we still see the Palestinian Authority collaborating directly with the Israelis. And that's, truly appalling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that we are out of time today. So let me thank our guest, Omar Zaza, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next week, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers. In Islamic upbringing,
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids? That is from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran. for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to answer your questions, queries that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakawi, who is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University, Qom. Assalamu alaikum, sir.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you much.
It's a pleasure to be with you again. And today, we want to discuss a very important topic that has to be balanced, and that is parental involvement in a teenager's life. What do you think? How much important is it for a parent to get involved in teenager's life?
Yes, thank you. It's a very difficult situation for parents who want their children to do what they like, what they think is correct. And children, especially teenagers, they want to become independent. They want to become, especially from their parents, they want to say, for example, there's a lot of peer pressure also. There are children, there are people around them who are making fun of them. Your parents are always, you know, micromanaging your things. They find people laughing at them.
Like your
joking.
Mama's boy, or your mama's girl.
So this is something which is there, especially internally also. The teenagers want to, they feel sort of, you know, they want to become independent. They want to stand up on their own feet, make their own decisions, take their own decisions and do what they want. So basically, on the other hand, parents are very much concerned with what's happening, and they feel very much stressed themselves if they find their children, their teenagers, doing things which are not appropriate.
Right.
So, number one, of course, they need what we always say, that teenager that age is a very sensitive age. If we want to, we should have done something to prevent that situation arising where now there's this this conflict,
right?
Where there's tension between the between parents and children, teenagers. It should have been taken care of before that. That friendship and that, you know, level of confidence and trust should have been developed before that, previously, at an earlier age, where the child was ready to listen to you more. Now that he's past 14, 15 especially.
Ready to become an adult now.
And now he's, or she's becoming an adult or has become an adult. And of course, as we always say, this generation gap, I mean, the generation gap between us and our parents was not so wide as it is now.
Now, unfortunately.
And in the future, it will become wider.
Right.
So, I mean, this is something which is happening. So we need to bridge that gap at an early age, and so we need to work together as parents. We should be able to work together, and we should be have confidence in each other also. That is very important. Otherwise, we cannot manage the teenagers. We need to be talking to each other's parents how to manage these things. Maybe a carrot and stick policy would be required. One of the parents takes a hard line, the other takes a softer line maybe, or maybe both of them take it depends on the situation. So, number one. Number two, we need to understand that in any sort of, you know, management, in any sort of management, if you start micromanaging things, we will never get things done. Because micromanaging
won't achieve the outcome as desired. That's very important now, and it's becoming interesting. We'll ask you about that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are talking about parent involvement in a teenager's life, which is in itself a very complex topic, as every parent-teen relationship is different. However, there are some general guidelines that can be helpful in understanding how much parent involvement is appropriate for a teenager. Professor, you were saying that this micromanagement of parents does not always lead to that desired outcome. Why?
As I was saying, that it's not true for any sort of management. I mean, in any sort of management, you need to motivate your subordinates, especially your children, your family members, to carry out things of their through their free will, because of their free will. They should be doing it because they feel it is right. They should be doing something right, which is because they know that it is right, and they want to do something which is right. They're not forced to do it. Then they will learn to do the right thing on the right at the right time and in the right way. Otherwise, if you're forcing them to do things, they will always be under the impression that, look, we're doing it for the sake of our parents, for this, because he's saying so. I need to you know, either respect them or just to do it because they say so. I mean, I won't be doing it on through my own free will. It will be something which will be forced upon me. So the moment that pressure is released, the moment I'm out of that situation, I will do as I wish.
Right.
So I will never learn to do the right thing at the right time. Even if my parents are going to tell me what to eat all the time, what to wear,
where to go, where not to go.
So we need to, the involvement should be, we should teach them what is right, what is wrong.
Right.
And tell them and set example by practicing what is right and what is, desisting from what is wrong.
Right.
Tell them what is right, what is, and do it for in front of them, show them how to do it. Now you can't force them to do it, especially teenagers. Yes, there was a time when you would have to order your child to 7 years of age, you need to order him to pray.
Right.
But a 14-year-old child, you don't need to, you can't order him. Make him do it of his own free will.
Right.
He should love doing what he's doing. He should like what he's doing. He should be motivated. He should feel that it is for the sake of Allah that I need to do it. For my own betterment, it's needed. Not just because my parents are saying so.
Now, this age of this teenager is not able to accept things which are forced upon him. And in our Asian cultures, like in our countries, like that of India and Pakistan, we have mothers who have this habit of doing each and every small, minute thing. For them, the teenagers never grow up. They see them as very small children all the time, all throughout their lives. Even when they are like marrying, I have seen that personally. Mothers take care of very single thing. And then these boys, especially, develop the problems in their relationship with their wives because they are very least responsible here. We will discuss more about this, how much parent involvement is necessary for a teenage development, after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Naqvi, and Professor is helping us understand how much parent involvement is necessary in a teenager's life, which is different in each parent-teen relationship. And there are some of the guidelines. Professor is helping us to understand how this relationship could be better, how this involvement could be balanced.
Involvement is very important. It's not the important thing to know is that we need to be involved. We need to be concerned. We need to be able to guide our children towards what is right and guide them towards what is wrong and make them stop doing it. Even minor things, it should be a matter of our concern. There's no doubt, because they are indicators of ourselves. They indicate to the society who we are. They are what we are. So we should be concerned that if they are not doing, if they're not showing a good example, it will reflect upon us. There's no doubt about that. But we need to take care of that in a better way. We need to be concerned, but how should we show that concern? That is important.
Right.
So by all the time budging into what they're doing and stopping them when they're doing, when you, for example, something wrong is being done, if you stop, if it's something harmful being done, so you need to stop it. But it's not something harmful. It's okay if it's done improperly, let it be done. I mean, for example, you expect your child to, you know, to take care of his own clothes, wash them, or maybe put them in the right place, be able to put them in the drawer in a proper way, in a very organized.
Be organized.
Way. But you see, he's not doing so. Let him do it. Then afterwards, in another way, in another session, in another environment, somehow, you know, indirectly even, tell him to do something which should be done, or should lead a story or tell a story or talk about it in an indirect way. So he or she does not feel that I'm being, you know, put to a test or a trial or a question. I'm being questioned or I'm being scolded for it. It should be done in a way that it is subtle. It is in a way that is polite, and it is somehow kind. And he realizes that my parents are being loving to me. They want to show me what to do properly. So, I mean, the feeling should develop in the child or in any subordinate, as the case may be, that whatever is being told is being told for the sake of my benefit, for my being a better person, a better human being. So that is important.
Right.
So we need to take that golden principle into our minds, that whatever we need to teach our children, we need to teach them by example. Number two, by setting rules and regulations as a whole, and not directly focusing our scolding or our telling them off, or, you know, it shouldn't
forcing
be
that forcing you mentioned that in the beginning. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That was so important. And so as parents, we should be realizing that our teenagers are actually now growing into adults. And this process involves developing their own identity and making their own decisions. So we should give them a kind of space. And they're actually in the stage of growing, maturing, and they need support from their parents, not things that they should that we will be forcing upon them, actually. So in general, parents have to be open and supportive in their relationship with children. They should allow the child to make decisions on their own as well and take responsibility of their own actions, because tomorrow they will have to be answerable in front of Allah for their own actions, themselves, not you as parents. Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. Allah, Allah.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoint about Hajj. Some accomplishment of Imam Ali might have somewhat reminded concealed. It is clear from his supplications. Kumail invocation is a wonderful litany, very marvelous. Some parts of the Kumail invocation cannot proceed from ordinary men. Oh my God, my master and my sustainer, let us suppose I can endure your chastisement. How can I stand separation from you? Who can make such entreat?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to listen to some sentences and precious words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about different subjects and then make use of them as great lessons for us and in order for us to follow this great character and the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. About the concept of infallible imams, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh has said, "In preserving the great prestige of women, all should imitate that unique feminine gem, Hadrat Zahra." Well, about the great character of Fatima Zahra, according to what Imam Khomeini has said, she is a perfect role model for women. From domestic and matrimonial issues to social participation and even patience and submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala are the hundreds of teachings of Fatima al-Zahra for modern women. Her great character has got lots of lessons, not only for women but also for men. For example, in the Holy Book of Quran, we read the commandment of being generous. On the night of her wedding, when Fatima al-Zahra alayhi salam was making her way to her husband's home, she was wearing a new wedding dress.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi.
Historical accounts narrated that a poor woman approached her for clothing to cover herself with. Rather than giving her the old dress which she had, Hazrat Fatima alayhi salam gave her brand new wedding dress and wore her old clothes on her wedding night. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said in Surah Al-Umran verse number 22, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم لن تنالوا البر حتى تنفقوا مما تحبون وما تنفقوا من شيء فإن الله به عليم. You will never attain piety until you spend out of what you hold dear. And whatever you may spend of anything, God indeed knows it. Okay, that's the time we've got for today's episode. For ending, let's just recite this sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about Fatima al-Zahra alayhi salam. In that regard, he said, "In preserving the great prestige of women, all should imitate that unique feminine gem, Hadrat al-Zahra."
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha
face to face.
Hello, welcome to the program Face to Face. I'm Kavitab Wade. Well, today we have the pleasure of having an interview with the Indonesian ambassador to Iran, His Excellency Ambassador Rani Prasetyo Yudhiyantoro. Now, the reason why we chose to have an interview with him is because Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi just came off his trip from Indonesia, and he called the relationship between the two countries after his trip a turning point. Well, we're going to find out what kind of turning point that is. Excellency Ambassador Rani Prasetyo Yudhiyantoro, welcome to the program, and thanks for... Sure. Thank you for giving us your time. As I just mentioned, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, fresh off his trip from Indonesia, talked about the context of Iran-Indonesia bilateral ties and regional cooperation, which obviously is in the works, in terms of how the world is gradually moving towards what's called multilateralism and multipolarity. Can you tell us how you evaluate the visit by the Iranian president to your country?
Okay. I would like to say that the visit of Excellency President Raisi to Indonesia was very successful. And, of course, bilaterally, the visit itself is opening the windows of cooperation between Indonesia and Iran more widely. And, of course, it's going to be the positive impact on our relations in the future, especially in the economic relations. And this visit, I believe, also gave opportunity for both countries to strengthen, to increase, to enhance their cooperation at the multilateral levels, whether within the framework of international or regional organizations such as United Nations, D8, IOC, or IORA, etc.
Well, that's great. That's how the Iranian president has also talked about Indonesia in terms of it being a window for Iran to open up its market with Indonesia and expand from there. Now, the country signed what was called a preferential trade agreement, which I'm sure you're well aware of, in order to expand these economic relations between the two. How significant was that?
What I see is the visit of President Raisi to Indonesia had been a heavy emphasis on economic science and technology cooperation. And of course, I also say that I would like to say that the visit also laid the foundation of economic infrastructure between Indonesia and Iran. And of course, both sides sign some agreements or MOUs with regard to the, among others, PTA, customs, and also the halal quality assurances. Of course, the PTA is one of the most important deliverables during the visit, because PTA is the important trade infrastructure that can optimize our potential, trade potential, through the market access. And then hopefully that with the PTA we can increase our trade in the future. But the most important thing also, I would like to highlight that the some economic agreements, of course, this is only the first step. The next more important step is how both countries can what you call it, can optimize this economic infrastructure through strengthening communications, whether G2G or business-to-business communication, to optimize the trade, the economic relations, and also to remove the barriers between the two countries.
Indeed. Well, one of the things that Iranian businesses was said by the Indonesian president, where there's opportunities that exist, especially in the export market, is for these businesses to invest in what's called the development of Nusantara on Borneo Island, which is slated to replace, I guess, Jakarta as the country's new capital. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that and how feasible that is and how quickly that can happen.
Yeah, actually, the government of Indonesia is currently constructing the new capital. We call it Ibu Kota Nusantara, or the stand for is IKN. And then, of course, Nusantara or Ibu Kota Nusantara will be built as the future city, the green city, as well as you know the we call it the world city. And of course, we to construct this, we need the investment in total $31 billion, and then of course this investment will be on various fields such as engineering, constructing, renewable energy, smart city technology, and others. And I believe that Iran has capability and capacity in some of this field. For instance, renewable energy, health, as well as a smart city technology. So in this regard, I would like to encourage the Iranian businesses to explore the, you know, the opportunity to invest in this new Indonesian capital.
Well, when you talk about Iran and Indonesia, both have lots of products that they offer each other. What's your view in, when it comes to Iran in terms of what it can offer? Basically, Iran is associated, obviously, based on its natural resources, such as oil and gas. So in that respect, it can provide Indonesia that particular good. What products can Indonesia, that you think is at the top of the list, that it can offer Iran when it comes to, I guess, bilateral trade?
I think a lot of, I think between Indonesia and Iran, I believe a lot of complementary items. So, for instance, Iran has energy, Indonesia has coffee, Indonesia has, you know, tires, and Iran has very good iron. So it is complementary between the two countries.
Sure. One of the sectors that I'm very curious about to find out from you, that I think there's a lot of room for expansion, given the fact that we're looking at two Islamic countries, is the expansion of Islamic tourism, or tourism that involves Muslims because of the shared values and the culture based on that. Do you believe that there's room for expansion there?
Oh, yes, of course. Tourism is one of the important role to increase, you know, our, or to make our relationship closer and closer. And I believe we have the similar background. We have similar as a, you know, as a Muslim countries. And then Iran has also potential. You have, I mean, Iran has potential in the terms of, you know, historical, ancient and also religious side. So you can, Iran can attract Indonesian tourists to come to Iran. I believe so, and vice versa. And probably we can also explore the history of Indonesia and Iran. For instance, how to dig up the history of spice road. Spice roads in the world, you know, in the back in the, I don't know, in since 1,000 years ago or something like.
Sure. Well, I'm sure your country is very rich in its history and culture, just like Iran is. And I think one of the best ways of doing that is using the medium such as the media. And through that, maybe some joint programs can be made in order to introduce each other's cultures, the diverse cultures, different aspects of it. Do you see room for there to be some co-opting when it comes to media production where, since we were talking about the culture of each country, that through some programs together we can introduce each other to that sector?
Yes, of course. I'm sure that we can do the the program involving the media, because the media is important to to distribute the information between the two countries. For instance, we can have some kind like I'm not sure about the one of a group of media from Iran go to visit some places in Indonesia to see what happened in Indonesia, something like that.
Well, of course, based on your discretion, we would love to, I'm sure, entertain that thought anyways and move ahead with it. Let's move on to what is really talked about a lot these days, and this is the idea of unipolarity and a transition to multipolarity. It's discussed a lot under this new world order. Now, Iran takes a look at the cooperation when it comes to, for example, ASEAN, and it places a lot of emphasis and importance on that. How do you see the future of the cooperation that Iran can have with ASEAN countries, especially when it comes to this transition that we're talking about from unipolarity to multipolarity?
Okay, I would like to say that the relationship between Iran and ASEAN as a whole was very good. I believe that Iran already signed the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation of ASEAN. I believe in, I forgot the date, but I believe in 2017 or 2018, I forgot the date. And then, of course, the relations between all members of ASEAN and Iran, I believe they have cordial relations. And this is the basic that in the future, the relationship between Iran and ASEAN will be, can be, might be strengthened. And then, of course, we understand that today the world is undergoing of a big change with some political and economic turbulences. But of course, ASEAN will and must face these kind of challenges, such as in the past that ASEAN have been proven successfully in maintaining the Southeast Asia region free of conflict and maintaining this region politically and security in stable condition.
Well, of course, Iran also is promoting the idea of peace, which obviously brings about stability, and ASEAN is no different in terms of Iran's views. At the same time, Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, during his trip, talked about how when it comes to the expansion of relations, this has to be done regardless of any pressures that might be exerted from the outside, which might include sanctions and threats. What's your take on that?
Aside of what already happening in the world arena, I believe President Raisi mentioned that the cooperation between Iran and Indonesia has been well established. And he also added that with the agreed cooperation will enhance the relation between Indonesia and Iran, especially in the economic sectors.
When it comes to how the two countries can enact any of the initiatives or MOUs that were signed, is there a way that this process can be speeded up or increase in terms of the time that elapses from the time those MOUs were signed and from the time the Iranian president visited Indonesia, so that the exchanges can take place in a rather speedy manner? Because the reason why I ask that is Iran's administration, headed by Ebrahim Raisi, is on a fast track when it comes to its international relations. I'm sure you're well aware of that. Iranian president just came off a three-nation Latin American tour, and he's been on this road to make sure that many countries it's enhancing and establishing new relationships with. Do you think that Indonesia also regards all the activity that took place, MOUs, signature, et cetera, that is going to move at a quick pace when it comes to Iran?
Yes, of course. I mentioned earlier that now both countries have to increase and strengthen the interaction and communication, whether at the level of G2G and also a B2B, business to business, to implement the agreements that already signed.
Okay. In terms of any ideas, opinions, or remarks you'd like to give us in this interview, when it comes to since the Iranian president has said is a turning point, I'm going to call it a new chapter in the relationship between the two countries. Any comments you'd like to make on that?
Actually, we've been in a very cordial and good relation, I think more than 70 years. And then with the visit of Excellency President Raisi to Indonesia, it will also give encouragement for Indonesian side as well to increase the cooperation with the Iranian side.
Okay. And in conclusion, I'd like to ask you about the Indonesian president. I covered the live coverage of that visit, and it was very heartwarming, the reception that the Indonesian president gave the Iranian president, not just him, but and his entourage, but Indonesians that were outside that area where the Iranian president was walking with the Indonesian president. I'm sure you saw that. Can you tell us a little bit more about the way Indonesians, what they think about Iran, ordinary Indonesians?
Actually, we have a very close relation. In terms of historical relation, we have a long, long relation. Go back to 700 years ago, and then we see the Iran is our friends, of course, and many Indonesia also studying in Iran now.
Oh, really?
Yes, around 300 students is here. So we encourage relations, not only G2G, government to government relations, but also people to people relations with Iran, such as exchange of students.